My Black Counts is a podcast series produced by the Center for Community Engagement, Environmental Justice, and Health, with assistance from WYPR.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to My Block Counts, an environmentalist podcast dedicated to helping people know so they can grow and help things flow within their communities. My name is Dr. Jacoby Wilson. Today's episode, we're going to talk about our upcoming Environmental Justice Symposium, Center for Community Engagement, Environmentalism, Health, 9th Environmental Justice and Health Disparity Symposium. Y'all may ask what a symposium is. It's a conference, y'all. It's just a special word for a conference. Before we talk about that, let me give you a little bit about myself. So I grew up in Mississippi. I grew up near a sewage treatment plant in a major highway. My mom always reminded me, son, don't forget the landfill. So I grew up near environmental hazards, but I'm from Mississippi, y'all. I grew up near the river. So very much connected to nature. You know, my pops was a pipe fitter. And so he worked at a lot of power plants in these pollution intensive industries that we know impact the environment and human health. But growing up on the outskirts of Vicksburg, Mississippi, near these hazards really got me interested in the environment, but wanted to understand how the environment impacts human health. And so I went to Alabama Agricultural Mechanical University. I was a biology ecotoxicology undergraduate major with a minor in environmental science. I had an opportunity in 1994 to meet Dr. Robert Bullitt, who's been called by some the father of the environmental justice movement, and also Reverend Dr. Benjamin Chavis, who coined the term environmental racism in the fight against the PCB landfill, polychlorinated biphenyl landfill in Warren County, North Carolina. And so when I met them at this conference in 1994, I knew I wanted to be an environmental justice scholar. I knew I wanted to be an environmental justice activist. I knew I wanted to advocate for communities that were dealing with pollution, who were being poisoned every day, and who were living in sacrifice zones, and who, as Dr. Bullitt would say, did not have the complexion for protection. And then we have some communities we know, because of redlining and segregation, talking about building resilient communities, who don't have the complexion for investments, right, y'all? So not just complexion for protection, but the complexion for investing to have healthy housing and healthy transportation, healthy food infrastructure, right? Healthy park access, healthy medical access, healthy schools. We have communities don't get the right kinds of investments. So we can have equal and equitable access to those types of infrastructure. So that's why I got into this movement. And that's why I'm a scientist. I do science for the people. At SEAGE, the Center for Community Engagement, Environmentalism Health, we really try to address environmental, climate, and energy justice issues by working with communities, doing science for the people, making sure that science serves people. Let me slow down a little bit for y'all. You may think about science as like this pursuit of knowledge. But to me, if you're just pursuing knowledge and not doing anything about the problems, you are part of the problem. So the science that we do is about empowerment. I empower. Helping people connect to the power that they already have through science, helping to make sure the folks have been impacted, that their stories have been told through their own data. So we're talking about doing community science, science again that's of the people, for the people, and by the people, and making sure we're doing action science, solution science, change science. That's what we do at SEAGE. That's what we're about. And we really partner with communities, providing technical assistance, doing capacity building, again, bringing tools to the people, helping the people create their own tools for action, their own tools for change. You don't have to have a PhD to be a scientist. You just got to be able to use a scientific method. And there's folks using science every day in communities. We got indigenous brothers and sisters who's doing science every day. Think about the traditional ecological knowledge of our indigenous brothers and sisters. Think about your grandmother, your great-grandmother, your grandfather, great, all the science that they were doing to survive and for Black folks and other folks of color to move from surviving to thriving. So our goal is to support communities, again, through science, using science, their own community-driven science to impact change. Now, what's the purpose of the podcast? The My Block Counts podcast takes a deep dive into environmental issues. impacting communities of color, low-income folks who are experiencing these environmental injustices, these climate injustices, these energy injustices, right? And taking into account how government policies, taking into account how planning and zoning, taking into account how we build communities and we leave some people behind, right, in that process. Some folks' voices are not heard as we build our communities, as we maintain our communities. This podcast is about how your neighborhood counts, how your block counts, and what the issues that you may be experiencing and what you can do about it to make sure you have good quality of life, that you are healthy, that your children are healthy, that your family is healthy, and that you get the resources that you deserve. We want to make sure this podcast that people can address any economic and health inequalities. And so we want to use this as an opportunity, as an avenue to educate, empower, and also inspire. So let's talk about this symposium. We have this upcoming symposium, hashtag UMD EJ Symposium 2023. At this symposium, we really want you to join us. We're going to bring together community members, folks who from communities are impacted by environmental, climate, and energy injustices, advocates, nonprofit organizations, community organizers, researchers, students, policymakers, health officials, so we can have a discussion. We can break bread together. I like to say, yo, when you want to address these issues, you can't break no emoji bread. You got to break bread together in person. So the symposium is an opportunity for us to come together, talk to each other's peers, do peer-to-peer mentoring and peer-to-peer sharing so we talk about these issues, but not just problematize, okay? Solutionize. No, Jesse Jackson said that, but he didn't say it. I said it, but y'all get my point. We just don't talk about problems. We talk about solutions, okay? So this symposium is going to be September 11th through the 16th. Over 5 days, we'll be examining critical challenges, environmental challenges, climate-related challenges that people are experiencing in the U.S., internationally, in many ways with a focus on the Mid-Atlantic and also specifically a focus on the DMV, D.C., Maryland, Virginia area. So if you're interested in attending the symposium, please put that on your calendar. But that's not all, folks. You know, you think about our agenda, September 11th and 12th, those sessions are virtual. Now, we're going to have a celebratory event on Wednesday, the 13th. Now, Thursday, September 14th, we're adding a hybrid twist. So some sessions will take place virtually, and other sessions will take place in person at the University of Maryland Stamp Student Union. But the excitement doesn't stop there, folks. We'll be continuing with in-person sessions on September 15th and 16th at the same venue. So the idea is the first 2 days, we focus more on national, international issues when it comes to environmental, climate, and energy justice. And then on Thursday, we have hybrid session when we start focusing on the Mid-Atlantic region. And then Friday and Saturday is really about what's happening in the local communities, in Delaware, in Virginia, in DC, also our family in Pennsylvania, folks in Maryland. So we have a major focus on those states, and we have a lot of sessions, a lot of trainings, workshops, opportunities for peer sharing, best practices, lessons learned, and how we build a strong EJ movement in the Mid-Atlantic region. And that starts with the Mid-Atlantic Environmental Justice Coalition and the acronym, Everybody is Magic. I know y'all like that acronym, right? So here's the best part. It's free, folks. Come together to learn about these issues. Come together to get skills and training. Come together to be a part of a movement. And it's free because we're about the people. We're about people solutions. We're about the people driving change. So don't miss out on this opportunity to be part of this transformative experience. Register now at our website. And our theme this year is people, power, and politics, right? Think about that. People, power, and politics. With all what's going on in our country, with Supreme Court cases, with this administration's focus on environmental justice through the bipartisan infrastructure law, Inflation Reduction Act, we got the first Black governor in the history of the state of Maryland. Politics, y'all, but people drive that. Remember, to make a democracy work, it takes work. So we're going to be talking about the work we have to put in to make this democratic process work for the people who've been invisibilized, work for the people who've been marginalized, work for the people who've been dumped on, work for people who've been forgotten. But remember, everyone, environmental justice is about representative justice. The people's voice has to drive the politics. We're going to talk about that at the symposium. Now, last year's symposium, we had a theme that was energy versus power. Y'all get that? Energy versus power. We had 40 dynamic sessions. We had over 100 speakers. We had 1,800 people registered, including folks from the U.S. and communities all around the world who are dealing with environmental, climate, and energy justice issues. We had individuals from environmental justice groups, green organizations, academia, government officials, policymakers. We had workers and folks from the business industry sector. So with this year's session, this year's theme on people, power, and politics, we're going to dig in more, everyone. We're going to talk about toxic prisons. We're going to talk about air quality issues. We're going to talk more about energy justice. We're going to talk about the law and policy. We're going to talk about affirmative action. I ain't scared to talk about affirmative action. We're going to talk about Roe versus Wade and what that means for reproductive justice. We're going to talk about why you need to vote. I'm a member of Alpha Phi Fraternity Incorporated, and we have a program called A Voteless People is a Hopeless People. So we're going to have to talk about the power of the vote and why we have to make sure we drive folks to the polls to ensure that we get the right representatives that make sure you get the justice that you deserve. We're going to have great keynote speakers. Reverend Barbara is going to open us up on Monday, reflect on the anniversary of September 11th, and help set us up for the week. We're going to have Justin Pearson of the Tennessee Three, an EJ advocate himself from Memphis, who's going to be one of our keynote speakers. We're going to have Robin Morris from the EPA talk about what the EPA is doing on environmental justice. She's an EPA senior advisor to the administrator for environmental justice. And we're going to have Reverend Lennox Yearwood Jr. of the Hip Hop Caucus. Last year, he was a keynote speaker, and he blew us away. He had me crying about the impacts of environmental justice on children and why we need to step up to protect our kids. And I like to say, how you going to put America first, folks? You're going to put your kids first. So he's going to come back again to speak about the issues of environmental justice, the issues of energy justice, and why it is our job as parents, as family members, to protect our kids and what we can be doing more to protect our children. But even more than that, he's going to regale us in these issues, in the work that he's doing with the Hip Hop Caucus, and how, again, we can work together, bridge across difference to have an impact on not just our children of today, but the children of the future. Y'all remember, if you don't know anything about environmental justice, look up the 17 principles of environmental justice. The framework is comprehensive. We talk about renewable resources, sustainability. We talk about protecting Mother Earth. We talk about the legacy of our indigenous brothers and sisters. But we also talk about communities have a right to self-preservation. We also talk about protecting workers. We also talk about human rights. This framework is a powerful framework. This symposium is grounded in the 17 principles of environmental justice. The work of SIEGE is grounded in the 17 principles of environmental justice. The work of this podcast, My Block Counts, we have to be grounded in the 17 principles of environmental justice. We have to be grounded in the environmentalist framework to make sure we are improving the health and well-being of our communities, ensuring that our communities have environmental quality, air quality, water quality, ensure that folks have the rights. You have the human right to clean air, clean water. You have the human right to safe housing and safe food. That's what this podcast is about. That's what the work of the SIEGE is about. And that's what the work of the symposium is about. So join us for this enriching experience where we'll highlight resources, we'll help you build your skills and knowledge necessary to tackle environmental justice issues. We're going to talk about the Thriving Community Technical Assistance Center, the Region 3 Center, and how you can get involved with that to get services. We're going to talk about our Climate Action Hub and how you can get support from the Climate Action Hub. We're going to talk about the air quality monitoring that we're doing in communities across the Mid-Atlantic and how you can be engaged to get air quality monitoring support. We will talk to agency leadership about what they're doing to advance the Justice 40 initiative. You may not know what Justice 40 is. You can look it up. But that's a framework to make sure that as we get federal investments into the disadvantaged communities, that they receive 40% of the benefits from those investments, right? So that's part of President Biden's Executive Order 14008. I call it, just to cut through the lingo, call it planting the seed for reparations. And guess what, y'all? We're going to have a plenary session at symposium on reparations and restorative justice, okay? Get ready for that, too. So it's going to be an exciting symposium. We have an exciting agenda, and we really want you to be there. Again, it's a free event. And remember, hashtag UMD EJ Symposium 2023. The future of environmental justice awaits, and you are the future of the environmental justice movement. In today's episode, we have the pleasure of being joined by remarkable leaders who have dedicated their lives to making a positive impact on the world. Our first guest is going to be Wakira Poole, a Central Day employee familiar, a trailblazer in her own right. These leaders are my colleagues. I've been working with them for a while, but they are the types of folks that you want to hear from to how you can have an impact on environmental justice issues. Wakira's story is one of resilience and determination, having to overcome personal challenges to emerge as a fierce advocate for environmental justice, a fierce advocate for Latino and Latinx people and families in the DMV and beyond. So welcome to My Block Counts, Wakira. Really excited to have you on the show today and just really want to hear from you. So first question, what was the driving force or the pivotal moment that inspired you to establish Central de Apoyo Familiar as a nonprofit organization?
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. It is a pleasure to be here. Yes, I guess one of the greatest move and impact in my heart to start the organization back in 2006 through 2008, when we started to do a lot of the community work and organizing, with the fact that a lot of families were losing their homes due to the housing crisis that we experienced in 07, 08. Unfortunately, there were not enough housing counseling agency in the county, in Prince George's County specifically, to work with the Latino community, getting access of how to get help in keeping their homes without having to go through foreclosure. So having my professional experience in housing and community development, I felt that it was my calling at that time, when I started to see so many families in my neighborhoods, in my church, that were about to go into foreclosure without having anyone who can understand, guide them, and providing the support they needed in order to keep a roof over their head.
Thank you for that. So my next question to you is, just to kind of dig into this a little bit more, can you talk about the services and programs that your organization offers to the community?
Yeah. So, you know, we started to do foreclosure prevention. However, in 2012, we began to do first-time home buyers, financial literacy, and also environmental health. And it was from the experience that we started to help a lot of homeowners. They were going to a lot of issues with indoor pollution. That's what motivated us to start integrating some of the housing work with environmental health education, and making sure that every family have access to this information. There was unfortunately, a lot of misinformation in the Latino community. They did not connect the dots on how health and environment could be connected. And so we began to do a lot of work related to that. So we've been doing housing work, environmental health education, environmental justice. Also, we began to do food security. There was a lot of our community, they were in need of access to healthy food and connected to, you know, to their health. So we are able to connect with over 200 faith-based organizations with churches in the community, where we're able to collect healthy food which are provided by many of our partners, and be able to feed the community with healthy food. In addition to that, we realized that a lot of these families also needed a job. So we began to start doing work related to workforce development. Right now, we have one of the largest bilingual transportation workforce development program based on transportation, providing people CDL license and training in a bilingual setting, and also able to get them jobs where they can work a decent job in the community while at the same time they're learning about environmental health, even in the transportation industry.
I mean, one of the questions to follow up about, you talked about your environmental justice work, and I remember we had lunch at the Bus Boys and Poets. Was that 2011 or 2012?
That was actually 2015.
Okay, 2015. Okay, sorry, 2015. I hadn't gone to Bus Boys and Poets often. It was great to, you know, have lunch with you at Bus Boys and Poets. And so the question is, you know, you talked a little about environmental justice. Could you talk more about how the environmental justice framework plays and, you know, how your organization addresses environmental disparities in the communities that you serve? How does it connect to what you see around social determinants of health in the communities that you serve, and also health equity issues in the communities that you serve?
Well, first of all, you know, it's something that we see happening more and more, and it comes with education. The community we serve, which is mainly an immigrant community, has a lot of challenges. And we start with, you know, the language barrier, but also the lack of knowledge and information about the different environmental struggles and issues that we all face and how they are connected to major issues that people are dealing with health-wise and social issues at the same time. So one of our major strategies is to make sure, first of all, that we bring education and awareness. We have found a tremendous support from the community once they see the connection on how the environment can affect their lives, the life of their families, generation, you know, their health, jobs, everything is connected. They are being more willing to support and to fight and to join the fight for environmental justice. So we have, as an organization, what we've been doing pretty hard is bringing awareness and education through organizing and getting the community involved and identify those issues so they see where they are, and what they can do about it. How can their voices be heard? And how can they be more, I will say, more active into fighting for that and be less silent about this issue? Because, you know, we're dealing with a community that, because immigration is a big deal, that we have a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of people that are undocumented and they live in houses where the condition is really, really bad with kids, elder people. They don't say anything because they are afraid of their immigration status. You know, we want to make sure that they understand that health comes first and that they have the support from an organization that can guide them and can support and can lift up their voices without having them to live in the condition that they are. You know, we also making sure that they know that this air quality that we are living through, they have, you know, the opportunity to learn what are the different ways that they can prevent health issues. We have a lot of these immigrant community that have the blue level jobs, you know, where they exposed to chemicals that are not right. Just recently, a few months ago, we had one of our promotoras who shared with us, you know, her testimony, how she owns a cleaning house business, and all the products that she was using, all these chemicals, were just damaging her health. And she was mostly in the hospital getting asthma attack all the time. She didn't know what was the cause until she learned, you know, that what she was using for the living, what she was using to provide and bring money into her house, into her living, was actually causing her all this disease, respiratory disease, that was causing those asthma attacks. So education is huge. Once people are educated and they connect the dots, they're more willing to support and to join the fight, which we've seen happening more and more through the movement and the work that we're doing within the Latino community here in the county and the state.
Thank you for that. I mean, that's the importance of education, increasing people's critical literacy and knowledge on these issues, and by educating folks, increasing their agency. And we talk about empowerment. it's really, again, what you're doing is helping people connect to the power they already have. They can use that power and activate that power. And you talked about food issues. You talked about air quality issues. You talked about chemical exposures. Those are some of the disparities that you see in the Latino community. Can you speak more about, from a population level, like you said, you're dealing with a lot of immigrants. What are some of the big population level disparities, environmental disparities that folks are experiencing? And you mentioned example of the promotor who's having asthma. Is asthma a big issue in the community, or is it exposure lead paint a big issue? Can you talk about some of those big issues that folks are experiencing?
Yes, absolutely. We see a lot of asthma being one of them. And it's unbelievable how much we've seen that more and more people who are coming to the doctors, they're coming to the hospital, or they don't go to the hospital because they don't have insurance, you know, which is another issue. We have a lot of uninsured people who have to deal with, they have to go to work, deal with this, being exposed, and then not having access to that. Then we have, as you mentioned, you know, food security is extremely expensive for them to eat healthy. So they don't have access to healthy food. And unfortunately, that just add another layer to their health. Then transportation, again, a lot of these community members, they have to be exposed into community where transportation probably is becoming a big issue because of how the air is being polluted. We also have this issue of, as I mentioned, housing, living in conditions where there's lead paint in there, but also in addition to lead, it's just the quality of air. It's not well in those houses, living on basements where there's not circulation of air. You know, we having a lot of our community members that are into construction business. And just recently, I have this young guy who came over to us having participating in one of our programs and just realized that a lot of his rash that he was having in his body was coming because he does gardening. And, you know, as his job and the chemicals that he was using, it was causing it. Like he understood and learned. Now, the issue is, what is he going to do? Am I going to quit my job, or am I going to continue to be exposed to this and get an income? You know, now what should I do? I don't have access to go to the doctor. These are the different pieces that we keep bringing over and over that at the end of the day, they all connected, you know. It's about job security, it's about food security, it's about housing, but it's also about making sure they have access to environment that is healthy, and that doesn't add more to their quality of life and also to their health situation that they all being exposed to. We have a large number of our community, and I will tell you, this happened just last week. Last Saturday, I was having an event right here in the county. I had about 295 families who show up. Out of those families, they came because of the food. Of course, we were having food, but also we had health screening going on. And the number of people who had diabetes in that, it was huge, huge. The number was alarming. And, you know, those are the kind of things people, they don't know. They have such a high level of diabetes and high blood pressure, and they keep working, they keep, you know, doing things they're doing, but all these pieces that are in the air quality, the food that they're eating, is adding more and more to the health of these community people. And we're losing them, we're seeing more, and I'm hoping that we can get access to the data in the hospital, how many of these people are coming to the hospital, if they're coming, because a lot of them, they don't get to go, are connected to air quality and environmental issues. And I wish hopefully we can get that data, but it's something that we see happening more and more. And I see it every weekend. Like, and this is why I fight so hard in our community, because if we don't provide this state of date to our community member, we're talking about a community that is just gonna continue to be in the same situation, repeating over and over. These are people that need to feed their kids. And if they don't do that, the next generation ended up not in the best situation, you know, which we see happening over and over.
Thank you for that. So you really talked about the social terms of health, housing quality, transportation quality, access to food, and occupational exposures. And the fact that many of the residents that you serve may not have insurance, and what that means when having a health event, you know, a health crisis, and not being able to get the proper care. And also because of status issues or language issues, mm-hmm. There is the care as well. So you think about how do we provide support to communities who are experiencing these issues and the intersectionality of those experiences, right? Because of the hazards they're exposed to, but also because of some of the social determinants that play a role in their ability or inability to get the proper care and get the proper treatment. For the audience, I want you to share next, Wakaria. Your organization, like you said, has been around since 2008, and you've had a lot of successes and challenges. Can you highlight some of your notable achievements in your work for the listeners today and any obstacles you want to talk about? But I'd rather you focus on the successes. But go ahead, Wakaria.
Sure. Let's start with the challenges first, and I hit the successes last. But I think that was one of our first conversations when we met Dr. Wilson back in 2015 is, you know, we began to do environmental health out of our in-kind contribution, let's put it that way, because we knew it was needed. As we were working with homeowners, we also knew that our responsibility was to bring education there. And we have talked to, you know, the Department of Housing and say, listen, this should be included into their first-time homebuyer seminar. This should be a standard. Of course, you know, doesn't happen, but we do it anyways because we know it's something that we have to do to educate our community. But one thing that we felt that it was inconsistent funding opportunity to mobilize, educate, and really provide the level of service that our community deserves in on the environmental health piece and environmental justice and also advocacy and all this work all together. So part of the challenge was also being consistent with funding so we can add more opportunity to the community. Also, you know, in addition to funding, which, you know, is kind of like a general thing that we always push in to make sure that it's consistent and it's sustainable and we continue to do the good work and add more people into this work, is making sure that our community are engaged in this process. And part of the challenges we had at first was to really engage the community in this issue. When we were doing always community assessment, environmental health was always at the bottom. Like people felt that that was not a top need. There was always job or housing or food. But then once they started to be educated, now we're seeing environmental health issue to be picked on the top because now they're putting the dots together. And so again, you know, part of the challenges was back then was educating, engaging the community. Now, part of the successes that I have to say that we helped to meet those challenges, one is with the funding, I'm glad that I met you back then. I'm glad that we continue to fight this together. Through you, we have been able finally the organization to be connected to organizations like NAMATI, organizations like working with the University of Maryland. And it's starting to add funding opportunity that is helping our organization to be more consistent with the work on the environmental justice work and meeting this challenge of awareness and engagement in the community. The way that we have fought a lot of this work is being through connecting with leaders, you know, community leaders whose voices are very well respected and heard in the community. This is not something that happened within a month or a year or 2 years. It happened through the connection and collaboration of key leaders. And I will have to say that faith-based community has been huge help for the organization. Whenever we do work, we try to educate the leaders, the faith-based leaders, which we have understood that is huge in our community to be part of this fight. They educated and they are aware of the issue. And then they helped me educate the community. You know, a lot of this information doesn't come from my voice. It comes from them. When they present the issue and the solution and the movement, people take action. We literally see and talk to 15,000 families every year. And that's huge. And that is done through the amazing partners that we have been able to build and volunteers. You know, we have over 75 promoters. Those are community leaders that are ready to go and talk in the community and mobilize and organize. We do that in collaboration with that. So I think that has been a lot of our success. Also using a lot of our medias like social media, radio, you know, we target close to 2 million people here in the DMV every week that I can definitely ensure that they're listening to our voice, and we're educating them through a radio program that I host that reach over 2.5 million Latino every week. And so that's huge, because we're able to really use all the different connections that we have, and we blessed to be bilingual. So we able to provide all this information in a bilingual way, because at the end of the day, we're part of the minority group. And so the Latino, we consider to be a lot of the same issues we're dealing with. We make sure that as we target the community, we bring all this in a bilingual way, also knowing that we have a new generation that is growing in this country that feel more comfortable speaking in English. You know, those are the kids of these immigrants that came to this country. And so we make sure that all the information coming in a bilingual way, and also we're building up the platform so that the next generation, the next leadership, they'll be able to take over and be able to sit on the table and be able to fight for these issues that we're dealing with, continue to fight.
Thank you for that. That was great. You talked about engaging youth. You talked about best practice of making sure you're being culturally competent and being bilingual. And the next question that I want to ask you is, you know, you do a lot of work, best practices and networks and partnerships. You have faith-based networks, faith-based engagement seems to be an integral part of your mission. Can you talk about engaging with churches and what's been the impact to your work as an organization and the impact on the communities that you serve in? And do you have any specific programs with the churches that you can highlight for our audience?
Absolutely. I will tell you one thing, that we try to bring a holistic approach with the churches. One of the things for the environmental work specifically, we try to connect them with something that they felt comfortable with. When we put together our first environmental health, stormwater and climate change, we put it together in a perspective that they understood. You know, it was right on Genesis first, who created heaven on earth and the air. And so they kind of boom connected right away. So we always try to make sure that is we connect with the audience that we're working with. In this case, the faith-based community, it took us, you know, a little bit of time of bringing awareness and education to a handful of leaders. And then we were able to have them recruit and train others, because usually most likely a pastor will feel more comfortable following something that knows it have worked in another church. So when I had another pastor recruit another pastor, it was more successful than me trying to recruit them. So the way that we have been able to be successful is that we have built a group of leaders who recruit and bring other pastors to be part of that. And they share what they have learned and how powerful it's been in the community. We also started to create a leadership group, and that's very grateful to the Mid-Atlantic Environmental Justice Coalition. We began to work with them about a year and a half ago. And it was a leadership civic education cohort that we did. A lot of these faith-based leaders, they're the first generation here. They didn't go to school here. They don't know how civic education handled or was done here. So we did a lot of those so they can be more connected with the policy work that is being done. We wanted them to understand how legislation is introduced, how it goes to a law, and learning who are your elected officials, how do you talk to them, what are the questions that you might want to ask, how do you reach out to them. So we empower them with that, because they were always thought that they couldn't reach out to a lot of the elected officials and government officials and that are serving them. And so we exposed them to a lot of them and understood that they work for them and they have their voices are much needed in a lot of the issues that we've been dealing with. And with the youth, we built a component now called the Eco Youth Promoters, because I feel that we want to see more youth people coming go to school, into environmental justice education and further their education, and that they had no idea that this opportunity where they can further their graduate studies in both high school when they go to college. So we motivating them to fall in love with this and to be able to manage this issue and be able to talk and present and work in the community around this issue, specifically on the environmental justice part.
Oh, thank you for that. I think engaging young people is very important. We have an undergraduate environmental justice scholars program. Basically, it's an internship program for scholars, for students. And I think it's important to make sure that you're training folks from the community young people from the community. One of my community mentors, Omega Wilson, when I was a grad student at UNC Chapel Hill, he had something called the Dream Network. And so he had young folks who would go to the community meetings. They were learning about the environmental justice work. If you fast forward to now, many of those young people are lawyers. They have businesses in the community. Mm-hmm. And they're still engaged in environmental justice work from different perspectives. So as you're doing, those youth become part of the fabric of change in the communities that you're serving. So I think it's a powerful model for keeping youth involved early, right? And then having them involved later in life and having that impact in the community. The next question I have for you, Walkeria, when you're talking about young people and we think about young professionals, what would be your advice to young professionals who want to start their own organization to support their community? In the same way you started, you know, Center of Employee Familiar to support your community. Could you give them some advice based on your journey and your experiences?
Absolutely. I always believe in the power of giving. I had other people who helped me get what I'm here. But one of the advice that I said is follow your passion. Don't be afraid. One of the things that did come to me at first was fear, because I just didn't know how it was going to happen. But, you know, I'm the type of people that I go ahead and do it and then think about it. So after I jumped into starting the organization, I felt that now the next step was that I needed to make sure that it grow. And there's always people out there that are willing to support and help. And even myself, I have helped now a lot of people who want to start a nonprofit. Based on my experience, I help them walk them through, you know, building up the steps. But you have to be passionate. You have to focus on picking something that you're passionate about, because that's going to drive you. You know, there's been time where it becomes so challenging that unless you're being passionate and committed to this work, you could easily just give up. But when you go back and you say, no, you know what? I'm doing this not just because of me. It's not because of wanting to do something, but it's because I'm assigned to do something. I'm committed to do something. I'm passionate about this issue and I'm going to fight for this. And if there is one thing that I always try to model the next generation is that, yes, you can do it. You know, I came here to this country, didn't know a word in English. I didn't know anything. I didn't have a clue how to start doing a lot of this work. But I'm grateful for the educational pieces that I was able to get here and there, and the people that were willing to mentor and support me through this journey. And I continue to get. And now what I do is I give. And I'm part of this work that we're doing with the University of Maryland in helping build capacity. It's been so helpful because you can connect other people to face one of the major challenges sometimes that you have is like, how do I get funding for this? How do I get the right board members? How do I get the staffing volunteers? It's a matter of knocking. The door will be open to you, but you have to go out there. You have to be willing to sacrifice and find your time, you know, and I'm grateful for my family. They support me so much because it's something that you cannot do alone. You need the support of your closest people to you, friends and relatives, to walk with you in this journey. You got to be passionate. And at the end of the day, where there is a will, there is a way. You have to be positive. You cannot let situation people. I have had like hundreds of negative comments and people to discourage me. That will always be there. That's why there has to be a greater willingness to go after you, calling your passion and dedication, and you'll get it done.
It's powerful. Thank you for that. You got to know your why. You got to be your mission. You got to have passion, everybody. Yep. And you got to be focused and be driven. And remember, you're doing this for, I mean, think about Walkeria's story, to serve people. It's the greater good. So that's a powerful message to share with young folks out there, or just, not just young people, anybody out there who wants to start their own nonprofit foundation. I won't be an ageist, but these are inspiring words that you just heard from Walkeria. So the last question I have for you, Walkeria, is you're going to be presenting at the symposium again. That's September 11th through the 16th. And the theme is People, Power, and Politics. So can you let the audience know about what's one key takeaway? Just give them a little preview, one key takeaway from what you're going to share about your work at the symposium.
One of the key takeaways is, how do we make a greener world? How do we make this environment healthier? Greatest thing I feel is going to happen is that you will be able to connect with like-minded people, and you will be able to learn so much and even increase your knowledge. If you don't know anything, great. If you know some, great. If you know a lot, great, because this is about connecting and bringing each other and supporting each other and sharing best practices and how we can, at the end of the day, be able to empower ourselves so we can empower our community and be able to serve better in the different capacity that we've been assigned to work in the community.
Thank you for those powerful words. Great to finally get you on the podcast of My Block Counts. I appreciate the time today, Wakiria, and looking forward to continuing working with you as one of our core partners. And y'all learn more about what I mean by core hub partners when you attend the symposium. But again, appreciate the time today and looking forward to continuing to work with you and looking forward to what you present at the symposium. Thank you, Wakiria.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Wilson.
So this is, again, My Block Counts, an environmental justice podcast dedicated to helping people know so they can grow and help things flow. And right now, we got to make sure that money, our money is flowing into our communities to get to that justice. Those who are at the front line, remember, should be at the front of the line. So thank you again for joining us. See you next time or hear me next time. Dr. Wilson out.
You've been listening to My Block Counts. My Block Counts is sponsored by the Center for Community Engagement, Environmental Justice, and Health at the University of Maryland. Executive producer and host, Dr. Sakobe Wilson, with production assistance from Aria Wharton. Technical producer, Kelly Avent. Additional information about My Block Counts can be found at ceej.center or wypr.org. New episodes of My Block Counts are released each month. Please share and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review.